have Sunday afternoon worship services. And given the fact that it's 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, and this is a group of people that's usually not meeting at 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, the chances are pretty good that there's a number of you about this time every other Sunday afternoon are asleep. Which presents a particular problem for me. I have a hard enough time keeping our folks awake at home when they come expecting Sunday evening services. And I really don't know what to say to address that to you other than to tell you something that a friend of mine who preaches, his name's Harold Turner, Mike, Debbie, I guess probably know Harold, Sarah. Harold made the observation to me a long, long time ago. He said, if you'll take all the people who sleep through worship services and lay them end to end, they'd all be more comfortable. And I'm not going to suggest that you just lay down, but at least fake it so I don't get too terribly discouraged as we study together. I do appreciate you being here. Appreciate those of you that are visiting with us. Good to see Dan. I grew up in connection with the Spargo family. We used to see each other. I wasn't in camp. I didn't go to the Florida camps. I worked all summer while y'all were all playing. But we did get together and play volleyball and all that kind of stuff from time to time. It's good to see you. Always good to see Texas folks when you're off outside of the homeland, the fatherland. So Matthew chapter 4, begin reading with me. If you want to read along, if you just want to listen, that's fine too. Beginning in verse 1. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights afterward, he was hungry. And when the tempter came to him, he said, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Then the devil took him up into the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they will bear you up, lest you dash your foot against the stone. Jesus said to him, it is written again, you shall not tempt or put to test the Lord your God. Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory, and said to him, all these things I will give you, if you will fall down and worship me. And Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve. And the devil left him, and behold, angels came and ministered to him. This is one of those passages in the Bible that I find very curious. Not because it's hard to understand what's happening here. I find it curious because it says something about the nature of Jesus that goes to that aspect of His being that we do not understand. I believe with all of my heart that the Bible teaches that Jesus was fully man and that Jesus was fully God. I don't understand that. I don't think that it's within the capacity of the human mind to appreciate and understand that. We can accept it by faith because God tells us this. But even God Himself says, through the Apostle Paul to Timothy, great is the mystery of godliness that God came in the flesh. This is one of those passages that when you consider that Jesus was man, but Jesus was God, I just have a hard time sometimes grappling with it. Because if Jesus was fully God, how is this a temptation? And yet it was a temptation because it's described as such. And it was an important part of the work that Jesus did. And just because there are aspects of it I don't understand doesn't mean that it's not absolutely invaluable to me. Because, for instance, in the book of Hebrews, we are told in chapter 4 and again in chapter 6 that Jesus' work for us, His work as a high priest who intercedes for us, which our brother just mentioned in the prayer just a moment ago, that work that Jesus does now and forever until time comes to an end, that work is completely dependent upon Jesus enduring temptation just like us, so that He might, in the words of the Hebrew writer, be a faithful high priest, able to sympathize with our weaknesses because He was tempted like we are tempted. And then there is the aspect of His work as a sacrifice. If Jesus is not tempted like we are tempted, only to endure and be perfect, then He couldn't be a sacrifice to take care of my imperfections and failures. And so, while this is a passage of Scripture that I find extremely curious because of all the things I don't understand, it is absolutely vital to my salvation and my service to God. And there's a lot of wonderful things in this. This is a really good passage to read to try to understand about how Satan works. And we're going to talk about the wiles of the devil in a very direct way and dealing with temptation. And this is one of those passages that you can study to look at the strategies of Satan. Incidentally, if you go to Genesis chapter 3 and you read the account of Satan tempting Adam and Eve, there's a lot of interesting parallels in the way that Satan works in tempting mankind. He didn't pull anything on Jesus that He hadn't already basically pulled on Adam and Eve. And that's a real good study. That's not what we're going to study, but it's a good study. And it's a good study in regards to how Jesus dealt with the strategies of Satan and what Jesus relied upon. And then there is the idea that Jesus is driven. If you look at Mark's account, which is a very abbreviated version, Mark says that Jesus was driven by the Spirit into the wilderness. Matthew and Luke says that He was led by the Spirit. I think that simply is because this part of Jesus' life was vital to His work. And God knew that it was. And so Jesus had to endure this. In fact, as man, Jesus' temptation was an inevitable moral reality, a necessity. And I want to begin our study by making the observation that the same thing is true in our lives. Not because, like Jesus, we are God and man, but because, like Jesus, we are man made in the image of God. We are beings with moral understanding. We judge things in terms of right or wrong. I find this curious, and this is a side note, by the way. Evolutionary proponents have a hard time with certain philosophical realities, and here's one of them. Where does our sense of morality even come from? I mean, if we're nothing but... I got a dog in the back. He's a good dog in the back. He's a good hunting dog. But he does not judge things based upon whether things ought to be done or ought not to be done. He knows when he does something I don't like, but his conscience doesn't bother him. I guarantee you, when he digs a hole and I get on him and I walk off, he's not out in the backyard cowered down thinking about all the bad stuff he's done. He doesn't think that way. He operates by instinct. But man operates from a sense of moral ought. There are things we understand to be right or wrong. Even people who don't believe in God believe this. You don't believe me? Go steal their car. You know what they're going to say? You shouldn't do that. That's wrong. Hey, let me tell you something. That ain't wrong if we're all just a bunch of overgrown monkeys. It's not wrong. Now, you might say socially we have determined we shouldn't do that, but even that recognizes a sense of ought. We are made in the image of God. We are moral beings, and as moral beings, dealing with a God who has made demands, and a very real devil who is operating in a realm of trying to dishonor God, it is an inevitable moral reality that we will face temptation. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. Chances are pretty good for a lot of us before the day's over. And I can pretty much guarantee you it's going to happen at some point in time tomorrow. Now, we may not always recognize it when it comes, but the reality is, this is what we deal with in our lives. And Jesus dealt with it. Not only here, incidentally. If you read Luke's account of this same incident, in Luke chapter 4 and verse 13, the statement is made that when Jesus has finished with these temptations, that Satan left Him awaiting a more convenient season to come and tempt Him again. And His temptations, I think, probably were felt in a lot of ways just like ours are. In fact, Matthew chapter 16, when Simon Peter stands up opposed to Jesus, when Jesus says, I'm going to have to go and suffer and die, and Peter says, no, it's not. You're not going to. That's not going to happen. You remember Jesus' response to him? Get away from me, Satan. And we think, well, was he calling Peter the devil? He's recognizing in what Peter is doing Satan's attempt to cause Jesus to look for another way out. Jesus spent 33 years roughly upon the face of this earth, and I guarantee he was tempted every bit as much as we are. Satan didn't leave him alone after this interaction. But we can learn some stuff from this. Now, rather than doing a detailed analysis, I want to really use this as a kind of a beginning point to make some real practical applications or preparations for the fact that we're going to be tempted. If we're going to deal with standing against the wiles of Satan, let's at least spend one lesson this week talking about what I can do to be ready. And this is simple stuff. None of this is I'm not a real complicated person. This is going to be simple, straightforward things that are going to help us, hopefully tomorrow, simply to get ready for what Satan's going to throw at us. Okay? So, if you want to jot these down, that's fine. If you don't want to jot them down, that's fine. If you don't want to listen, just remember what I asked. Just don't lay down in the pew. Okay? Point number one, and these are going to be things that I think you see reflected in Matthew chapter 4. If we're going to be ready to deal with Satan, and by the way, 1 Peter chapter 5 reminds us to be sober and vigilant because our adversary, the devil, is out there like a roaring lion. I mean, this is something we have to deal with. My suggestion at the very outset is that we be very serious about the reality of temptation and what it means. Be serious. I think Jesus was very serious about this aspect of what was happening, because when the Spirit led him into the wilderness, he is there for 40 days and 40 nights. What do you think he's doing? Well, I think he's getting ready. He knows what his work on the earth is. He understands what he has come here to do. And he recognizes that as he is beginning this with his baptism, things are about to get taken to a new level of difficulty. And yet we live in a world that undermines and discounts and discredits the very concept of Satan and evil. I mean, we are in a self-serving society. A self-serving society that also has made great advances in regards to technology and education. I mean, we've just learned a lot about the world, even in my lifetime. Every now and then you read one of these articles, and I'm not quoting from one, I'm just acknowledging the fact that people will try to measure how much we've learned in the last 50 years compared to how much was learned in the, 500 years previous to that. I still haven't figured out how they can measure all that 500 years and everything that people learned, but nonetheless, technology has advanced in our lifetime in ways that are so far beyond what took hundreds of years to happen in the past. It's pretty impressive what people can do. I mean, I flew up here on an airplane, folks, and I know that that's fairly old technology, but it still amazes me. We're sitting there on the runway, and one of those things takes off over us, and I thought, good now, I'm going to get in one of those things and fly? I mean, I've done it 100 times, and yet it still fascinates me. And we get impressed with ourselves. This is part of the problem that there's no more faith in this world than there is. We get impressed with ourselves and what we've figured out and what we know and what we've learned, and then we start looking at the Bible that begins with a naked man and a naked woman living in paradise in a garden talking to the animals. And I've had people say, do you really believe that Adam and Eve were talking to a snake and arguing? Yeah, I believe that. And yet, people around us, because of the culture in which we live, they really want to kind of marginalize the reality of Satan and consider this whole good and evil thing as some outgrowth of our evolutionary reflection. That Satan's not real, that he's a mythological creature, kind of like somebody out of Aesop's fables. And that's the reality in what's out there, outside of our world. And as a result, that kind of thinking begins to influence us. Why is it that I argue with myself about what I should or shouldn't do when I'm confronted with some kind of temptation? Why do I have this little battle ongoing? You know, in the cartoon world, there's a little devil on one shoulder and a little angel on the other shoulder, and they're whispering in your ear. And that's the way a lot of people think of it. It's just an effort on our part to explain why it is that we think the way we think. But I want you to understand something about Christianity and about following Jesus and about being godly people. What this demands is that we understand the account in Matthew chapter 4 is absolute truth. That at some point there was a very real interaction between Jesus Christ and some manifestation of Satan on the earth where there are direct temptations that are offered to him that he has to deal with. Which also necessitates that we believe what happens in Genesis chapter 3. If you're going to be a Christian, you've got to accept this stuff, folks. If you're not going to accept it, you might as well deny your faith. We need to understand that while we can't explain all of it, it does not mean that it didn't happen. And it doesn't mean that this whole process of temptation is not a serious issue. We feel a sense of guilt or a sense of confusion or a sense of concern when we are confronted with temptations for a very good, serious reason. Don't discount it. In fact, in 1 Peter chapter 5, which if you want to flip over there, when Peter says, be sober, serious-minded. Be vigilant, watchful. Because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. What that says is he really is out to get you. And don't think that that's a fairy tale. I told my wife and I have this ongoing discussion about my peculiarities and her perfection. Mike and I were kind of having the same discussion with Debbie in the car on the way here. She told me the other day, she said, you know, you're just paranoid. And I told her, I said, if they're really out to get you, it's not paranoia. And the reality is, Satan's really out to get us. And you and I, we really need to get this through our mind and understand that this is a serious matter that really does happen in our life, and it's not some psychologist trying to explain why I feel guilt. If God's real, and this is a fascination to me, so many people want to accept that Jesus really lived, but they don't want to accept the rest of what Jesus tells us in the Bible. If Jesus is real, Satan is real. And Satan is really and making a dedicated effort to cause us to quit serving God. And the stakes are high. What if Jesus had failed? Have you ever stopped and considered that possibility? I don't know if you think in those kinds of terms. What if in Matthew chapter 4, Jesus had looked at Satan's temptation to take the stones and turn them into bread, and Jesus had started to rationalize that the way you and I do? Well, God never says, thou shalt not turn stones to bread. And it's been 40 days since I've eaten, and I really am hungry, and it's not going to violate any principle in the Scriptures. God didn't tell me not to do it. God didn't even address this to me. This is simply an issue of I am hungry. He's not asked me to fall down and worship Him. He's not asked me to violate anything. He's not asked me to disown myself from God in any way. What would be the harm? It is a kind of a curiosity exactly what the temptation here is. I think I understand it. But what if Jesus had said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. What would happen to us? I guarantee you we wouldn't be sitting here right now. We would have no hope. I can't imagine what this world would be like if instead of the last 2,000 years, Christianity exerting the influence that it has. And people can make all kinds of arguments about all the bad things that's happened because of Christianity. Don't discount all the good things that's happened because of Christianity. Imagine 2,000 years of a world without hope, with no Savior. And then having to be born in and live in and raise a family in that kind of world. What kind of person would you be? What if Jesus had failed? Jesus understood the severity of the circumstance in front of Him. Man dies eternally if I don't succeed right now. And do you stop and appreciate that our temptations are every bit as serious in their implications? In the book of Deuteronomy, I'm a big Old Testament fan. In the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 30, when Moses draws this rather lengthy discourse to a conclusion. He's got the children of the people that have come out of Egyptian captivity. This is 40 years after the plagues on Egypt. And everyone that came out of Egypt that were over 60 years old, they've all died in the wilderness, except for Moses and Aaron. And so you've got a fairly young nation of people, and they've won a couple of victories over on the east side of the Jordan River, and God's about to take them into the promised land. Some of these people would have remembered the plagues, because they would have been 15, 16, 17 years old. Maybe not the little kids, but there would have been some of them who were teenagers, and they would have remembered everything that happened. They would have seen God's activity, and they were going out and picking up manna every day, except for Saturday, and they had seen the water from the rocks, and they had seen God do all these remarkable things. And now Moses is telling them, look, you're going to go into this land, and I'm not going to be there. And here's a reminder of what God has done and the commitment that you've made. And when he gets to the end of this discussion in Deuteronomy chapter 30, he offers this challenge, if you would, beginning in verse 15. See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. In that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in His ways, to keep His commandments, His statutes, His judgments, that you may live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go in to possess. But if your heart turns away so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you will surely perish. You will not prolong your days in the land that you cross over the Jordan to go in and possess. I will call heaven and earth as witnesses against you today, that I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both you and your descendants may live. Moses makes it real clear. God makes it real clear. Here's the implications. If you do what you promised and what God asked you, God's going to take care of you. And if you don't do that, you are going to die, and life is going to be hard. Now, how many people on that occasion do you think went, man, that's a hard decision, Moses. You know, I've got to think about this one for a while. I mean, come on. Life or death? Blessing or cursing? Well, anybody in their right mind is going to choose the life and the blessing. I don't know what your temptations are. I don't know what it is that you struggle with. Don't need to know that. But I'm going to tell you this much, which is true for every one of us. Every time Satan confronts us, it's life or death, blessing or cursing. It's that serious. If Jesus had failed in Matthew chapter 4, we would have no hope. And we need to understand that if we fail, we don't need to spend our lives living in sin and counting on forgiveness constantly. God expects us to get better, not to live in sin and hope for grace. That's precisely the perversion that the Apostle Paul describes at the end of Romans chapter 5 and into the beginning of chapter 6. Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. The reality is, if we live our lives not taking temptation seriously, not worrying about the consequences of such, and just thinking, I can live how I want and I'll just ask God for forgiveness, now we're right back to that mental renewal that we talked about when we talked about self-sacrifice this morning. We need to be serious about the problem of temptation in our life and understand the implications and approach it that way. I don't know if any of you ever hunt. A friend of mine and I, we bird hunt. We quail hunt. We have bird dogs and run around. If you do this in South Texas, where I live, in the southern part of the state of Texas, then inevitably, sooner or later, you're going to run into rattlesnakes, especially if it's late in the season and it's starting to warm back up. You ever come up on a rattlesnake? You ever come up on any kind of a snake? It can be a garter snake that couldn't hurt a fly. What do you do? Well, if you're like I am, I dance around trying to get away from it, till I figure out whether or not it's really serious danger. I walked up on four different rattlesnakes one time on a bird hunt. By the end of the day, I was tired. I did moves that Michael Jackson has never considered in his entire life, trying to get away from the snake. And you want to know why? Because that thing can kill me. And I recognize that, and we recognize that, and it is a natural reaction. We don't go up and get as close as we can and play with it, because it's dangerous. Why? Why is it that we can't deal with temptation that way? I'll tell you, young people, here's a mentality that you better start developing while you're young. If it's morally dangerous, I do not need to have anything to do with it. I need to abstain from every appearance of evil, as we are told in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And yet, I'm not sure that we take it seriously enough. So let me suggest to you, Jesus was pretty serious about what was going on this occasion. Let's be serious. Observation number two, or suggestion number two, be spiritual when it comes to dealing with temptation. With whatever it is that Satan puts before you, understand that the tools that Satan uses are always the same. He is consistent in his approaches. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 following says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. All that's in the world. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, pride of life, not of the Father, but of the world. Now we have these desires. And these desires God has given us, that's a very natural part of our being. All kinds of desires. And these desires God has also offered in almost every circumstance, I guess in every circumstance, in regards to our natural desires, some kind of environment in which those desires can be lawfully, in a godly way, fulfilled. But Satan knows that we have these desires. And so what Satan does is he tries to take our natural desires and use them against us. Turn over to the book of James and understand that in James chapter 1, that is the argument that James is hoping to help us understand. James chapter 1 and verse 14 says, each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. And Satan uses these things. And that's what he did with Jesus in Matthew chapter 4. He used the fact that Jesus was hungry after not eating for 40 days. He used the idea, I think, perhaps, when he takes him up on the pinnacle of the temple and tells him to cast himself down, either the idea of display an ego. If you're the Son of God, throw yourself down. Everybody will believe you when the angels catch you. Or he uses the idea of testing whether God was telling him the truth when he said, you are my beloved Son. And so I'm going to put God to the test. That's what Jesus answers, by the way. Thou shalt not test the Lord thy God. Put God to the test. And this desire for display, or this desire for knowledge that doesn't demand trust, those are part of our makeup. He does the same thing in taking Jesus and showing him all the kingdoms of the world and offering Jesus control over those things. That's what Jesus came to do, to rule. And this was simply a shortcut. This appeals to that which is easy in all of us, that which doesn't demand sacrifice, that which is lazy. Satan appealed to the same desires in Jesus that he appeals to you and I. It may be sexual desire, it may be ambition, it may be ego, it may be hunger. You know, gluttony is still a sin, by the way. You know, we don't talk about those kinds of things, but Satan still uses that. I mean, we live in such a prosperous society, perhaps we need to think about those things. Because what he appeals to is our desires. And knowing that is our advantage. You want to know what the key to success in temptation is every time we're tempted? Every time we're tempted. It's pleasing God. If our desires are what gets us into trouble, and what we decide is, I'm going to give myself to God's desires, then we take away all the tools that Satan has against us, don't we? If you go back to Matthew chapter 4, I want you to notice something, if you didn't before, and I just mentioned it a moment ago. This incident takes place right after Jesus has been baptized. It's very clear in all three gospel accounts that the temptation of Jesus takes place almost immediately upon Jesus' baptism. And I want you to notice, or ask you to remember, when Jesus is baptized, Matthew 3 and verse 17, suddenly a voice came from heaven saying, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Interestingly enough, in Luke's account, chapter 3 and verse 22, God says, you are my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Now I believe that Jesus knew who He was. I think he understood that he was the Son of God. And here again, I don't understand what Jesus knew as a child. People, well, as a baby, did he have divine knowledge? I don't know. But I do believe that he understood who he was. At 12 years old, he knew to be about his Father's business. I don't think God's telling Jesus, "You are my beloved Son," because Jesus wasn't sure that he was his beloved Son. Maybe it was the fact that he says, I'm pleased with the way you're living your life. I'm not exactly sure. But Satan picks up on this statement because that's the way he begins two of these temptations. Did you notice that? If you are the Son of God, God's just said, you're my Son. So Satan starts it. If you are the Son of God, I don't know if Satan's attempting to create doubt, but he is addressing Jesus' understanding of his own identity. And Jesus' responses are successful for one very simple reason. When Jesus was tempted with the stones, Jesus wasn't concerned about whether he was hungry right then. Jesus was concerned about what God would want him to do. And when Jesus is confronted with the temptation to cast himself off the pinnacle of the temple, Jesus is not thinking through what this could mean for him. He's not entertaining the temptation for what it is. He's only thinking about the implications of that in his relationship to God. And when Jesus is shown all the kingdoms of heaven, what Jesus says to Satan is, You're in my way in regards to pleasing my God. You need to get out of the way. God's the only one I'm going to give my devotion to. Jesus said himself, I came down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. Now, what difference would that make in your life? If every time you were tempted, instead of seriously entertaining it, And let's just illustrate it with something simple. My wife makes the best chocolate chip cookies in the world. And she inevitably makes them for some school event and then tells me I can't have one. Come home from the office, the house smells like chocolate chip cookies, and there they all are, cooling on the cooling rack. And she, don't touch those cookies, they're for the band booster fundraiser. Are you kidding me? They smell great. I know how good they are. I know what they taste like. And the reality is you can tell me all day you can't have one. I'm going to eat one of them. You might as well hand it to me when I walk through the door. But let me ask you, if God said to me, I never want you to eat another chocolate chip cookie again. And I walk through the door and all that smell and all that sight and everything hit me the same way. And all I could think of was, I just want to make sure God's happy with me. You think I'd be less inclined to eat the cookie? Now I recognize that that's just a kind of a silly illustration. But it is precisely the key to dealing with temptation. Because if I'm thinking spiritually in my life, if I'm thinking in terms of the kingdom, like we talked about this morning, and what it is my king wants for me, what I'm trying to do with my life, and what I'm trying to do with the sacrifice of my body, and what's coming first, and my life is spiritually inclined. Romans chapter 8 talks about those who live according to the flesh are carnally minded, and those who live according to the Spirit are spiritually minded. And if my entire life is nothing but an effort to make sure I'm right with God, would that make a difference when you're confronted with temptation? I think that's really why Jesus is successful. Because Jesus wasn't just worried about a set of rules. Jesus was worried about a person. And how his failure would reflect upon his relationship with his father. Many of you know my dad. I was very blessed to have the father that I had. And I was a pretty good kid. I had my problems, but I was a pretty good kid when I was a kid. And I'm going to tell you part of the reason I was a pretty good kid. The worst thing in the world I could imagine is disappointing my father. He's been that kind of father to me. It wasn't the breaking of the rule that was such a big deal. And to be honest with you, it probably wasn't so much whether or not God would be happy with me when I was a kid. I was very concerned about what my dad thought of me. Is that the way you live your life when it comes to dealing with right and wrong and temptation? Businessman, you're trying to keep up with the competition, everybody else is being dishonest. Are you tempted ever to hedge the bids, to do the backdoor deal so that you can keep up with everybody else? And when that temptation comes along, do you ever stop and think, if I do this, what's my father going to think of me? I tell you, being spiritually minded takes care of all of our own desires, all of our own passions, and just focuses on what it is that God would like. And that helps us regardless of our temptation. Number three, in those circumstances, let me suggest that you ask God for some help. Jesus spent 40 days in the wilderness before this temptation took place. What do you think He did? If you know anything, if you've read very much about Jesus, what do you think He did for 40 days? Man, I can't imagine living 40 days out in the wilderness. And my strong suspicion is He spent a good bit of time talking to His Father. And every time you see Jesus pull Himself away from His apostles during the 3 years of His ministry that we have reported, He's going off somewhere and praying. And given the fact that He knows that He's about to spend the next portion of His life in a very intensified effort to tell people about the kingdom of heaven, and He's going to meet all kinds of difficulty, and He's going to try to train these 12 guys, and He's going to die at the end of it, my suspicion is He spent some time at this point talking to His Father and asking God to prepare Him, to help Him. Why? Because He saw God as His Father. There's an intimacy there. And you know what intimacy does? Intimacy in a relationship. Intimacy is always willing to express itself and say, I'm struggling with this. I mean, if you have a good relationship with your spouse, which you should, you ought to be able to say, look, honey, I'm having a hard time with this, I'm having a hard time with that. Tell me what you're thinking. And you may not agree. The advice may not be what you want to hear, but just the ability to pour out your heart and your doubts and your weaknesses and your concerns to someone else. I think this is a vital part of our dealing with Satan and the wiles that he has. Part of this simply acknowledges that we need God's help. If you're in Matthew, turn over the other direction, a page or two, to the Sermon on the Mount again. And remember that when Jesus offers this model prayer, He says in Matthew chapter 6 and in verse 13, Matthew 6 and verse 13, do not lead us into temptation. Deliver us from the evil one. Yours is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen. This is something He's trying to get people to think about, to teach them. This is part of a sermon, remember. And He's trying to get people to learn to go to the Father as a father. And this would have been maybe a little change in the way that the Jews thought of God. This is a much more intimate view of God than I think the Jews probably had, although there are expressions of it in the Old Testament. But go as a father. In fact, he reiterates that later on in the same lesson. Go over to chapter 7. Before he finishes this sermon, he says, beginning in verse 7, ask and you will receive. Seek and you will find. Knock, it will be opened to you. Everyone asks, receives, and everyone who seeks, finds, and everyone who knocks, to him it will be opened. What man is there among you who, if a son asks for bread, will the father give him a stone? Or if he asks for... He uses that intimacy to say, look, you need to be willing to talk to God, so I ask you. And you have to answer this for yourself. When you're tempted, whatever the temptation is, do you ever stop right then and say, Father, I really need some help here. I'm struggling with this. You know what that does for you? It reminds you that you are not alone. It reminds you that the throne of mercy to which you are coming enthrones a very powerful being. In fact, in Hebrews chapter 4, we are told to come boldly to the throne of mercy to find grace for help in time of need. I can't always stop what's going on around me, but God has some control over what happens in this world. And that doesn't argue that there has to be some big miraculous thing that takes place. But you know what God does promise every time we're tempted? 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. A way of escape. Every time. And maybe the key to finding the way of escape is for us to come to the throne of one who can provide that way and make sure that we understand that He knows what we're saying and what we're doing and what our circumstances are. His eyes are over the righteous and His ears are open to their prayers. 1 Peter chapter 3. So, let me suggest to you next time you're tempted, talk to God. Number 4. So not all my sermons are 3 points. Number 4. Practice discipline. We don't like this one. The promise of God's help doesn't imply some supernatural power, as I just noted. What God does promise is a way of escape. But I want you to go back to James chapter 1, and I want you to notice, as James talks about this, he helps us to understand the process, and he makes a recommendation to us that really addresses the concept of discipline. James 1, verses 2 through 4 says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, but let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing." And then he goes along, and this discussion culminates in, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation," verse 12, when he's been proved, he will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love Him. Let no one say when he's tempted, "I'm tempted of God." God cannot be tempted of evil, nor tempts He any man. Each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Desire, when it's conceived, brings forth sin. Sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. The testing of our faith produces discipline. Strength. It's like lifting weights. You lift 5 pounds, after doing that enough, you can probably lift 10. You do that enough, your muscle reacts to the resistance, it can build up, you can probably lift 15. And the reality is that's the way the human body works. We recognize that it's the way that we work spiritually when it comes to dealing with difficulties in our life, including temptation. But at some point, we have to come to grips with this reality. If I fall to temptation, it's my fault. I failed in the process. Which means at some point I'm going to have to grapple with my will and making it better. Enduring the temptation. Learning the patience. Learning to make sure and wait on the Lord for what He has in store for me. And not give myself to whatever I want in my life. And that's hard. And I don't know an easy way to learn this. God tells us He expects self-control. Add to your faith virtue, knowledge, temperance, self-control. He tells us in Ephesians chapter 4, Colossians chapter 3, that self-control is to be something that we are to put on and make a part of us. So I ask you, is this something you work on? Because if, say, anger is your temptation, that's my temptation. That's one of my big ones. I am short fused. Don't know where it came from, but I know it's there. You pull out in front of me, oh, Satan might as well just be right in front of me going, "Get mad, get mad, get mad." I don't know why it is, but it is something I struggle with since I was a kid. If anger is your issue, at some point you're going to have to grapple with it. It's your desire. How do I learn self-control? Well, let me make a suggestion to you. Did you ever notice in the Bible that God demanded some things of the children of Israel that were issues of self-control? Under the old law, He divided the animal world into clean and unclean. And I've always been curious, why in the world did the Lord do that? People are very quick to say, holiness. And in fact, God does connect the concept of holiness with clean and unclean and recognizing that. But you know what that demanded of them? I can't eat shrimp. just because God said, I can't eat shrimp. Then when we get the New Testament, God makes it very clear there's not anything wrong with the shrimp. What's even worse is, I can't eat bacon. Just because God says, I don't want you to eat bacon. And you know what they learn from that? They learn self-control. I've heard people make arguments about fasting. In fact, I heard a young man make a sermon, offer a sermon one time, and basically said, you know, Christians, we ought to be fasting. Fasting helps us. Have you ever seriously fasted? You know, the argument is, if you fast, it helps you to suppress the hunger and the desire to focus upon spiritual things. If I fast, it just makes me concentrate on how hungry I am. But you know what fasting does do? It teaches me that my mind can control what my body wants. And the reality is, Christians probably need to exercise some control in our lives, simply so when temptation comes along, we've learned to deal with what our body wants. I try to exercise pretty well. I ran for several years, and I hate to run. And I've got a bad knee, and now I can't anymore. But I would run 2.5 miles every other day. And the last half mile at my house is all uphill. And that last half mile hurt. And I did it for one reason and one reason only. To prove to myself that when I wanted to run a half mile uphill at the end of 2 miles, I could do that because my mind said I could do it. And let me suggest that we learn in our lives to practice discipline in little ways. That's really the argument of James chapter 1, verses 2, 3, and 4. The trying of your faith produces patience. Let patience have a perfect work. You learn some discipline. And I'm not suggesting that we be ascetic for the sake of ascetic. But I am suggesting that we practice things that will help us to be disciplined people so we can be better prepared to deal with temptation when it affects our desires. Now, how you do that, I don't know. Push back from the table quicker. I made this observation in a meeting, by the way, earlier this year, and then we went and had a potluck dinner. And as I'm sitting there eating a piece of strawberry pie, somebody came up and said, you're not going to finish that, are you? I said, well, why wouldn't I finish this? And they said, hey, aren't you the one talking about self-discipline? I nearly threw it at him. But I would offer seriously that we practice some discipline in our lives because that will help us. And then I would suggest in conclusion, we practice what the Lord, through Paul, told Titus to tell the people in Crete. If you can get through all that. We need to be zealous to do good stuff, to do good works. I'm going to tell you, if you're involved in doing good things, teaching the gospel, helping somebody out, you don't have a whole lot of time to think about the ways that you're tempted and what you want selfishly out of your life. And I mean, I think part of the reason that Jesus was so good at what He did in living a life of dedicated godliness is because He was so busy giving Himself to what is good, He didn't worry too much about Himself and what was selfish. And this is serious stuff, folks. You know, if you fail in today's temptation and die, what's going to happen to you? It's serious. So be spiritual. Ask God for some help. Be disciplined. Go out and do good things so that when Satan comes and tempts us, we're ready. And we can deal with his wiles. And we can be sober and vigilant because God tells us you resist him and he'll flee from you. So, I appreciate your attention. I know that's kind of long. But it's your fault because you listen so good. And you keep listening. If you'd all laid out and started sleeping, I'd have probably quit about 30 minutes ago. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. If you failed in this very serious matter, then you've been blessed well enough, long enough, to have an opportunity to repent. If you need to make your life right, you need to fix whatever temptations you have failed at, be serious about that and take care of that. And if it involves some public thing that you need to take care of publicly, we invite your response. If you've never obeyed the gospel, have your sins forgiven. Come to the Lord today. While together we stand, while we sing.